Welcome to tonight's Science in the Pub event. Thank you all for coming. The topic of tonight's discussion is how science works. So this event is live in the Black Hole Bistro at Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. Also, welcome to everyone watching online, wherever you are around the world. We have an exciting evening of science planned for you tonight, but before we begin, I have a few announcements of housekeeping. This event is one of the many being held as part of Canada's Science and Technology Week, something that we're very much proud to be involved and part of. It is being taped and will be available online afterwards at perimeterinstitute.ca. In terms of content, we'll start with a one-hour discussion with our panel, and then we'll have 30 minutes question and answer period with our live audience. So if you are going to ask a question, we are just ask that you please keep that concise, on topic, and limit yourself to one question so we can get through as many people as possible. So on to tonight's topic. It's an exciting time to be alive. Everywhere you look around, you can see signs of progress. New buildings are going up. We have new gadgets that allow us to access vast amounts of information in an instant. And we can travel from one place to another faster than any time before and more conveniently in human history. We also have what is perhaps the most amazing invention of the 21st century. Yes, I'm talking about the slanket, the sleeved blanket that combines the comfort of a blanket with utility of clothing. It is indeed an amazing time to be alive. And it's truly an exciting time in science as well. Theoreticians at Perimeter Institute and around the world are working hard on big, new, bold ideas that may revolutionize our understanding of the universe. These ideas, amongst many other things, involve the origins and the evolution of the entire universe, the fundamental particles and building blocks that make up everything around us, and even ideas that relate to unifying quantum physics and gravity into a single unified theory. It's also an extraordinarily exciting time for experiments. We have the Large Hadron Collider at CERN just about to fire up, and it has already, collecting data, and a number of other experiments around the world that are giving us insights and data and windows into the world that may transform again everything we know about the physical world. Tonight, we'd like to take stock of the situation and look at what physicists are doing today. Specifically, what some of the big ideas around at the moment are, what the motivations are, and how can we assess them and know if they're correct. Ultimately, we'd like to look at progress in science and also the process of science and how it's working today. To help us, we have a panel of three expert researchers to my right, and they span three different, very different fields in physics. So we'll cover a wide range of topics, but in true physics style, we'll try to unify them all with a common thread. Perhaps we'll even come up with a single equation we can print on a t-shirt or a coffee mug by the end of the evening. Physics joke. To introduce our panelists, we have Louis LeBlanc. Louis is a postdoctoral researcher here at Perimeter Institute. He grew up in Quebec City and got his PhD from Cornell University in 2006. He was then a postdoctoral researcher at the Mitchell Institute for Fundamental Physics at Texas A&M University. And in 2009, he moved here to Perimeter Institute to take up his current position. His research lies at the interface between high-energy physics, string theory, and cosmology, and particularly is interested in theories of the early universe. Amongst other things, he works on dark energy and inflation. And in his spare time, he enjoys hiking. So to his right is Astrid Eichthorn. Astrid is also a postdoctoral researcher here at Perimeter Institute. She was born in Frankfurt, Germany, and she got a PhD at the University Jena earlier this year. After that, she moved to Perimeter Institute to take up her position here in the field of quantum gravity. And she has actually just been at Perimeter Institute for 2.5 weeks. So thank you for coming on board. Her research focuses on trying to find a unified theory of quantum physics and general relativity. In particular, the idea of asymptotic safety, which is an idea trying to find a unified theory of these two ideas, trying to use as much as possible from current established theories without introducing new ideas. In her spare time, she enjoys playing the violin. And finally, we have Itai Yavin. Itai is an associate faculty member at Perimeter Institute and an assistant professor at McMaster University in Hamilton. He grew up in Israel and obtained his PhD from Harvard University in 2006, and then held research positions at Princeton and New York universities. He started at Perimeter Institute just last month, and his particular area of research is particle physics. He's most concretely interested in electroweak symmetry breaking and its origins and the nature of dark matter. More recently, he's worked on interpreting puzzling data coming from the lab related to dark matter, and in his spare time, enjoys learning new languages. But enough of the panel, and on to tonight's content. So I'll hand it open to them for their opening remarks. And what I'd like to ask of each of you to talk about is what you're working on, some of the big ideas in your new fields of research, what their motivation is, and how will we know if they're right? So ultimately, how will we make progress via the process of science? So I'll hand it over to you, Louis, first.
Okay, well, thank you, Damien. It's a great pleasure to be here. I hope you guys enjoy and participate a lot. So, yes, yeah, so as Damien already said, I work in the early universe in physics, so I have a wide range of interests, but lately I've been mostly working on trying to understand the early universe. So this sits in the field of cosmology, which you may have heard about. It's essentially the study of the history of the universe. And it's very interesting science. It's sort of a bit booming right now. There's a lot of things going on. It's a bit surprising that it works at all as a science, because cosmology is about looking at the universe, and you know, as you probably all know, science is an experimental science, and the universe is not something we can reproduce. Right? There's one universe, and there it is. And so it's always a bit strange. For a long time, cosmology was actually not really working as a science, because we just didn't have enough data, essentially. But the thing that saves us in cosmology is that there's just a very, very big universe. And so even though there's only one of it, it seems for some reason that the things in it, like the galaxies and the stars, there's just so many of them, that they were reproduced in many, many ways. And so we end up with just by the sheer number of things in the universe, by just the vastness of the universe. We have good statistics, and the last 30 years there's been just tons of data, and cosmology has really truly become just as good as a science as many other parts of physics. And so in fact now it's so good that not only are we actually able to test our ideas of how the universe has evolved, just the model of the history of the universe, but now we can use cosmology to test the fundamental law of physics. In fact, we can test the laws we already know, just to check whether they agree. Like, we can check whether gravity works, as we think it does, regarding galaxies and stuff. But also, it's more than that. We also have been able, in fact, there was some striking discoveries coming from cosmology that tells us that we need to go beyond the laws of physics that we know. So you probably have heard, and we'll probably discuss more, but like dark matter and dark energies are the prime example. My research, I don't know how long I have with this, but my research is more...
We have an hour in total.
Okay, good. Because I could go on and on. No. So my research is more... So I'm interested in dark matter and dark energy. I'm interested in general in using cosmological data to test the laws of physics. But also, in particular, I'm interested in the early universe. So the universe, as we know it, seems to have started with some weird initial conditions. So the universe is expanding. Everything is going away from us, and it's inhomogeneous. It's not just a smooth universe. There's a lot of structure in the universe. There are galaxies, there are stars, and we have we can explain all these structure form if we assume some set of initial conditions. We assume that we didn't start the Big Bang completely smooth. If we had some set of initial conditions, then we can explain. The galaxies and the clusters of galaxies, which are just group of galaxies, and we can sort of relate, you know, we can sort of understand everything, sort of. But the initial conditions themselves are very strange. You have to put all these perturbations in at the onset by hand, and that just seems very awkward. And so my work has been on trying to extend the physics that we know so that you can have a mechanism that will generate these perturbations. And so. And that's one of the theories that's the foremost, and this is inflation, and it's a very interesting theory. It's somewhat challenging to test, whether it's true or not. And so I think I'll hand here, and then hopefully we can discuss this more as the evening goes forward.
Absolutely. I'm going to hand it over to Astrid now.
Well, thanks, Damien, and thanks a lot for having me. So the area that I work on is quantum gravity, and this is a very exciting field of research because it's a field where we don't have a theory, an established theory yet. So people discuss different ideas, they discuss different theories, and a lot of ideas are just being, you know, produced every day, and people look at it from very different perspectives. So it's a very exciting field of research. So you might ask, well, if we don't have this quantum gravity theory yet, why do we even know that we need a quantum gravity theory? Well, the reason for that is that the theory of gravity that we have, which is general relativity, breaks down in special places. So let me just very briefly, in a nutshell, give you an idea of general relativity, as I don't know how your background is. So general relativity basically says that matter curves space-time. So I'm sure many of you know this picture of a rubber sheet and a ball or a marble on top of it, which curves the rubber sheet. So just imagine the rubber sheet is space-time, and this ball can be any kind of matter. It could be the sun or could be you or whatever. And then any particle traveling on the space-time will be, due to the space-time curvature, will be attracted to this larger body. So this is in the essence of general relativity. Matter curves space-time, and space-time curvature tells matter where to go. Now, this theory is very well tested. It works extremely well. We can describe many things in astrophysics in it, for example. Also, we needed to get the GPS working to the precision that it actually does. But this theory breaks down in some places in the universe. It breaks down in so-called space-time singularities. So you find these in pretty exotic places inside the black hole, or you find them in the very, very early universe at the Big Bang. And what general relativity predicts there is that the space-time curvature becomes infinite. So if you think of it, this seems very unintuitive, and in fact, it's not physical, it just tells you that the theory breaks down. So you have to put in different physics, you have to change the theory, and then you will get a reasonable physical answer. You will get a finite number if you ask what the space-time curvature is there. And we actually even know what we are missing from the theory. We are missing quantum effects. So quantum effects usually become important at very microscopic scales. So, for example, in atomic physics or in elementary particle physics. And so these quantum effects will be important when we come very close to the space-time singularities. They will change the theory there and will presumably remove the singularities. Now, this is what we are trying to do in building a quantum theory of gravity, but we haven't a theory yet, but we have some kind of a picture of what this theory will predict. So, in a very loose way of speaking, quantum physics tells you that things become fuzzy. So what I mean by that is that, for example, a particle doesn't travel along a path, but it's position and moment and velocity cannot be measured to arbitrary precision at any instant of time, as you probably all know. So now if we put in these quantum effects into gravity, what it means is that space-time itself will become fuzzy and start to fluctuate. And the point where different physicists disagree is how exactly this works. So all the different approaches to quantum gravity have different ideas about how the space-time fuzziness really works. And so there's a lot of discussion going on. And the challenging part about it is really that, unfortunately, it's very, very difficult to come up with an experiment that could test these ideas. So this is because we have to go to very, very tiny scales or to extremely high energies, which are far beyond the reach of, for example, accelerator experiments. So this is the real challenge in quantum gravity, is to come up with an idea, how can we test it, and how can we decide which of the many approaches, if any, is correct and which of them is wrong. So that's what I'd like to start with.
Fantastic. Itai.
Thank you. Thank you for all being here. It's amazing that so many people are here. I'm a particle physicist, as Damien said, and generally particle physicists are interested in what matter is made of. What is this beer made of or this table? I know you know now the answer better than I do. But the basic question is, what is matter made of and what are the forces that shape matter? And over the last century or so, we have made amazing progress. We now know what this table is made of. It's made out of atoms, which is probably the most fundamental discovery in the last century, is that we are made of atoms. And atoms themselves are made of smaller constituents, and there are forces between them, and there is quantum mechanics and all these wonderful things that Astrid mentioned. And we learned so much that in some ways it's too bad for me. I came to the game too late. There's not that much to discover in some sense. You know, we may know what the table is made of. We know what the stuff that makes up a table is made of. We even know what atoms are made of and even the nucleus. So we really discovered an incredible amount of information. But there are two big problems today in particle physics. One of them is clearly a problem of particle physics, and that is radioactivity. We still don't quite know why radioactivity is what it is. We don't quite know why does the neutron decay at the time it does. I mean, we know how to describe it, but we don't have a full theory that tells us what happens in all scales. And so, and this is known as the electroweak theory. This is one of the under-identification schemes that Damien mentioned. That was one of the triumphs of the 70s, that people figured out that electromagnetism, which is this force that binds atoms together, is actually intimately related to that same force that causes radioactivity. And that was one of the greatest unification of physics. But we still don't quite understand how that story unfolds all the way to the end. So that is definitely one of the problems of particle physics, and we are testing it, as Damien said, at the LHC. So that's one end of the story. But then there is this other very curious thing that, you know, if you like, Copernicus brought about the idea that we are not the center of the universe, that in fact we are revolving around the sun. And a few centuries later, or very, very, very quickly afterwards, people realized that actually our sun is not that special either. It's part of a galaxy and it's revolving around some center. And then later, even our galaxy didn't turn out to be that important. And even that cluster of galaxies that we are in is not that important in the grand scale of things. So we really, our ego has diminished so much since. But the funny thing of all is that like nature is really likes to remind us that we are small. And so in the 20th century, it showed us that we're in fact not even made of most of the matter in the universe. Most of the matter in the universe as we know it today is a form of matter we call dark matter, for lack of better description. And we are not made of it, that's for sure. And that is one of the biggest problems in general in physics today, what is that matter is. And the reason why it's connected to particle physics is because particle physicists like to understand what matter is made of. So whether or not it's actually a problem of particle physics is not entirely clear yet, but we are working on it when we try to understand more about it. And one question that I'm particularly interested in to run the story short is, you know, we call it dark for a reason. It's because as far as we can tell, it emits no light. It does not interact with light. It doesn't like light. It's dark. And the question is, how dark is dark? Right? That's a very simple, naive question that any child can ask. How dark is really dark matter? And there are, once you ask it, there are very, very precise answers or attempts to try to answer it that we can write down. And once we wrote it down, once we formulated it correctly, we can go to our experimentalist friend and ask them, how dark is dark? And tell me you, what do you find in the lab? And this is one of the things that excite me a lot, because there are now big experiments that are trying to find dark matter in the lab. So maybe in a couple of decades, we can hand you a bottle of dark matter. Of course, by that time, all the dark matter will escape because it's not interacting, so the bottle will just be empty. But the label would be the most important part. So there are very big experiments now going on to search for it. And moreover, if there is any interaction with light, maybe we can see it in astrophysics. Maybe we can see special light rays that are emitted from parts of the universe. And there are big satellites now that are looking for that, for those signals. So in short, that's one thing that I'm very much interested in these days.
So that's very exciting. For a split second, I got very excited. I could become an entrepreneur and start my own online business selling dark matter on eBay. But
lots of ideas.
Fantastic. So one of the things you talked about was some of the problems today, some of the mysteries still out there. I guess to kind of sort of an outsider, if I'm just, you know, knowing a little bit about physics, how kind of big and significant are these mysteries? How much do we still need to learn about the universe? Are they mainly, you know, kind of just technical questions, or are they really big questions where there's large things that we still don't know about?
Should I go ahead?
Yeah. Well, there you have the largest problem. So
yes, exactly. That's true. In fact, there are some depends how you phrase it. It seems sometimes that the theory, so like the standard model of particle physics, is amazingly successful. Mm-hmm. Never been a theory. I think it's fair to say it's never been a theory. It's been so successful, tested in so many different ways to such a high level of precision. So in some ways, we're extremely successful. Science is working very well. It's just like we're just getting really to the bottom of things. We just know everything that's on the almost most of the things in the lab on the planet. Anything that we can do, you know, locally, we seem to understand very well. But when it gets, for example, to the universe at large, then it looks kind of ridiculous because, indeed, as Itai was already mentioning, we are only a small portion of the content of the universe. 85% of the universe is made of dark matter, Seventy percent of the universe is made of dark energy, and about 25% is made of dark matter. So we're only 5% of the universe is actually us. So it's ridiculous. It's just like most of the universe's stuff, we just don't know what it is. So when you put it like that, it looks like we haven't made much progress. But so in some sense, there are really still very big questions to be left. And some also, the standard model is well understood, but one of the key components is still missing, and Delici is looking for it.
Okay.
So I think there are some very conceptual things still. It's not just technical level.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that when we are missing 90% of the picture, you're missing the picture.
Yeah.
yeah. I'd say that's a fair statement. I would agree with that. So something a lot of people ask me, I used to be a theoretical physicist. And when people think about Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics and the ideas and the theories you're working on, they say, well, how will you know that they're right? How will you know that they're correct? How do you test them?
Right, so I think that's a very general question that can bring about hours of discussion of what is the scientific paradigm? Mm-hmm. And over the last century, we had evolution of ideas about what is the scientific paradigm. Mm. And at some level, you know, it started with this idea of falsifications, that for something to be part of science, you need to be able to run experiments, to ask Mother Nature, what do you think about my silly little idea? And she has to give us the answer as for yes or no. And if your theory doesn't allow any such sharp test for your idea, then it's not quite science. Mm-hmm. So one thing that is maybe important to dispel is that science never proves things. We can never prove a theory. Mm-hmm. We can only gain confidence in the validity of the scope of the theory by asking Mother Nature again and again, what do you think about this experiment? And here is my calculation. I predict that you should show me this. And she shows you that to 12 significant digits.
Okay.
She's generous.
Yeah.
So this idea of falsification is a very important part of what I mean by science. The problem with it is that if you actually try to be very gung-ho about it, almost any theory is false because at some point or another, it maybe ran into some conflict, but of course we are all reasonable people and not all experiments are right and some experiments are wrong because of one of various reasons.
Yeah.
So really it's a very human endeavor where there are clashing opinions and clashing ideas that come in and out. And I think at some level, Max Planck, the father of quantum mechanics, said it very poignantly at some point. He said, new theories don't triumph because they manage to convince their opponents of their validity. They triumph because their opponents die. And a new generation grows that is familiar with those theories. Now, of course, he was being a little facetious about it, but really his point was that a real new paradigm of science doesn't just triumph over a single experiment. Mm-hmm. It triumphs over a decade or two decades of continuous puzzles and continuous confrontation with experiment. And only after that long and arduous process do you finally find yourself in a state where you think, yes, this paradigm is better. It's not a relativistic thing. Not all they're all okay. Some of them is good and some of them is less good. And the theories we have today are better descriptions of nature than they were two centuries ago. Mm-hmm. So I think this idea of falsification together with this idea of paradigm shift that you know, we discussed before, that emerged in the 60s by a work by Kuhn. I think if you try to take any one of them to an extreme, you'll find yourself pretty puzzled. But we all human beings, we're reasonable, and if you, that's sort of guidelines as for how science progress.
Okay, great. Is there anything you wanted to add to that, Astrid?
Well, maybe from the quantum gravity side, you know, so testing against an experiment, that would be of course great, and that's what we all wish for and what some people try to work on, coming up with ideas of maybe in cosmology or in astrophysics, you could see tiny, tiny quantum gravity effects accumulating over the large distances that we see in astrophysics. But really in quantum gravity, we are even one step further back, where when we start from a theory, we make different assumptions, and then if we put them all together, we have to see if we get an internally consistent theory. Now, this sounds like a pretty easy thing to do, right? I make a couple of assumptions and I see if, you know, if they clash or if they don't. But actually, it's not as easy to do that. The calculations involved can be pretty hard, and so it can take quite a long time to see if the assumptions that you have made about the nature of space-time really go together, or if maybe sometime some of them clash and some of the quantum gravity theories will just die because it turns out that the assumptions that go in are just not compatible.
Okay.
So this is maybe the first hurdle that a new theory has to take, is to show that it's really internally consistent. And then we can check it against experiment. And of course, your particle physics and cosmology is just way ahead of quantum gravity.
Okay.
Oh, we are so much better.
Just to follow up on the idea of experiments and tests and so forth, one thing probably a number of people have heard about in the news is these neutrinos that may be going faster than the speed of light, or maybe not. A recent result that was out there, I guess, you know, what are we meant to make of that? And what are you as scientists, how are you assessing that? And maybe how can you compare that to other results from experiment that have been very surprising? I mean, just last month, the Nobel Prize in Physics was awarded to the discovery of data that led to dark energy, that there were these supernovas accelerating and moving away from us faster with higher redshifts than previously thought back in the mid-90s. So how can I make sense of all of this? How can we?
Should I?
Louis,
start
yeah.
again?
Yeah.
I'm the starter on every questions now. So let's see. So the supernova, this is a very, the neutrinos is a very interesting result. It's by the OPERA team, which is at Gran Sasso. So in case you haven't heard the experiment, so at Gran Sasso, this is really cool, actually. And all the credit to the experimentalists, they're just amazing people. This is, in fact, I think it's Zikiki at CERN, who thought about this when they constructed CERN. So CERN is this at the LHC, right? This big ring accelerator, and they're accelerating these protons and antiprotons and colliding them at high energy. And when they devised this thing, somebody realized, you should put it in this direction, because maybe one day you may want to shoot your proton in that direction. And that direction was Italy. And the reason is there was another lab in Italy at Gran Sasso. So this is CERN is in Geneva in Switzerland, and then Gran Sasso is in Italy. Okay. So the idea is they're shooting their protons and they're colliding them with a. Correct me if I'm getting all this, but I think they're just colliding them with a big, you know, rock, essentially, a big piece of solid. And then out of the debris, some neutrinos are being launched in the direction of Italy. And then in Italy, they do the biggest, you know, it's a very simple experiment. The only thing they want to do is measure the distance between Italy and Geneva. And this is not going through, you know, road, you know, this is going through the Earth. So they're measuring the distance between the two places and divide it by the time. That's the experiment. Take the distance, you divide by the time, and that should be giving you the velocity. And they found a 6 sigma deviation from the speed of light. So 6 sigma means, so you have a Gaussian is a distribution. 6 sigma means you're quite a bit in the tail. Statistically, it means you're very, it's very high significant statistically. But still, a lot of people are doubting, because obviously this is such a big, if true, will be a huge revolution for science, because it means that the neutrinos will be going faster than anything. You'll be, you know, in the face of Einstein and all this stuff. But at the same time, there's a lot of doubts, because first of all, it's one experiment. So physicists are always very doubtful of any one thing. We need duplicity. We need multiple things. It needs to be confirmed. It needs to be redone multiple ways. It needs a lot of confirmation. And also it needs to, it just doesn't fit in. And there's just no reason for neutrinos to go fast. I mean, it doesn't, And we need just nobody has any like, okay, great, this explains also this. You know, it doesn't. It doesn't explain anything else. It's just, wait, this is a surprising result. Nobody expected. It doesn't help you in any way. So that's a bit. And it's a semantic, but maybe I'll give the chance. I'm sure everybody wants to chip in on there. But systematics error is also potentially doubtful. Okay. Somebody can explain this. But
yeah, I mean, in regard to the not fitting in, I think it's even more severe than that. It's really not an uncalled guess because it's in contradiction with several other things we know. Now, of course, some of those contradictions are model dependent, but they are pretty severe contradictions to other observations we have had of neutrinos, where they don't seem to propagate faster than the speed of light, and in fact we have very strong bounds on how fast they propagate. So as Louis said, it was first, the experiment itself is a single experiment, and you should never trust a single experiment. Second, it's a very difficult experiment. It's not something that you measure a single quantity and you're done. They really need to estimate several very unrelated quantities, and they have to make sure they understand the path and all the delays that happen on the way, and there are many delays. I mean, even this simple question, you know, it was maybe the simplest thing in science, right? If you took physics, one thing you probably know is how to calculate velocity, right? It's distance over time. But the crux of the issue, how do you measure the time? Like, how do you know when do the neutrinos left CERN and when did they arrive in Italy? I mean, there is no custom control to tell you when that happened, right? They abolished that in Europe. They have Europass now. This is the real problem that how do we measure that time accurately? And they cannot really do that. They need to estimate certain delays that happen along the way, and from those delays they get some correction to the final number from which they subtract. So it's a fairly involved measurement, and so if you take all those things into account, it's a difficult measurement, it's a single experiment, they're not really called for, they're in contradiction with several other things. This is why people are so doubtful about this result. But the great thing about science is that this is just an opportunity to do other such experiments, to think more carefully about how we can measure it, to expand our horizons about what we know about nature. So whilst people are skeptical, and that's a very healthy thing, they're also thinking about ways to test it, which is ultimately what we do in science. Mm-hmm. So.
Maybe I had actually. It just generated just here at PI so many discussions. People said, "What if it's true?" And then since it's so weird, it really takes a lot of physicists talking in direction and things they haven't even thought before. So often when you have a weird experiment like this, it's fun because you get to think about things you never really thought about. Yeah. Okay, what if a neutrino is faster than light? You know, and that's something I had thought before. So it just generates a lot of discussion, which is again great for science in general.
And the funny thing is that what Damien mentioned, the supernova discovery of the acceleration of the universe, in fact, we were all babies when that happened. We were barely conscious in high school, thinking about many other things. As we discussed, and maybe Louis can tell more because it's his expertise, but that result was not as doubted as this neutrino business, right?
Yeah, I wasn't, like I said, I was just finishing high school. But yeah, in 98, they discovered that the universe was accelerating, and this was the Nobel Prize recently for dark energy. And this was also surprising, but there was two experiments, independent, two teams, got the same answer. So that already helps a lot. Yeah. It was actually less statistically significant, but there was less of, the systematics, which is how do you understand what you're doing, that was maybe a bit better. And also, it really did help that, I mean, it would still have, the discovery of dark energy was still extremely controversial, okay? A lot of theorists, still to this day, don't believe it, okay? The dark energy is a weird thing, okay? Dark energy is what, the hypothesis that you have this substance that makes the universe accelerate. It's a very, we have no clue what it is, it's very strange, and the acceleration of the universe was a big surprise. But it was better accepted because, well, yeah, it was two teams, and there was also, there was less, it was fitting in a little bit better. Essentially, back then, they had some problems, like the age of the universe was small, lower than the age of the Earth. Yeah. It's kind of a problem. So, and then that sort of explained, so it was explaining other things. And so, slowly but surely, even a lot of the skeptics started accepting it. that may be true, you know, but.
Okay, no, great. So I'm kind of feeling old at this point because 1996 was the year I started my PhD, so I think I must be definitely the oldest person on the panel, but moving on from that. So Astrid, one of the things you talked about was kind of internal consistency in making assumptions and checking that. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about that, because perhaps that's a little bit different to maybe what a lot of people think about a traditional idea of science, where you come up with hypotheses and then you go out and you do an experiment, you go into the lab and experiment, you know, tells you yes or no, or gives you some results, and you kind of don't have that luxury in quantum gravity at the moment. So you need to perhaps be a bit more creative.
Yeah, basically, I think in quantum gravity, many people start from some kind of picture that they have in mind of what space-time should be. So I think you can divide the quantum gravity community really in two groups. One of them thinks that space-time is discrete, and the other thinks that it's continuous. So what do I mean by that? So a discrete space-time would mean that if we go to very, very small distances, then we suddenly see that space-time is not this continuous rubber sheet, but it really breaks into small pieces. Like you can think of, for example, of Lego stones, you know, where you have one of which is the smallest one, and then you can build large structures out of it, but you cannot split this smallest one. So this is the way that many people think of space-time as being something discrete. So you would have atoms of space-time. And if we take an incredibly powerful microscope, which we obviously don't have, but just think that we could do that, then we would at some level see this discreteness, and we would see that there is like the smallest instant of time that we could have, and we cannot split it any further. So this idea has been very successful in explaining matter, right? This atomic hypothesis. And so this is why people think, well, maybe it also applies to space-time. And then there's the other group of people that says, no, I like the idea of this continuous rubber sheet, and when I go to smaller and smaller distances, I never see anything like an atom of space-time. It always stays continuous. It can fluctuate very widely and do very weird quantum things, but it will still stay continuous. And this is something which we cannot test by an experiment currently. This is just a prejudice that people have, an idea that they have, and then they try to see if when they start from a hypothesis like this, if it will be compatible with everything else that we know. So for example, a very big challenge is if you have some idea of a quantum gravity theory that on this small scales, it's just this weird ensemble of atoms of space-time, then if you go to larger scales, imagine that you take your microscope and you zoom out of it again until you're at the scales that you know from everyday life, like centimeter scale. Will you then get your space-time back as we know it, like, you know, three spatial dimensions, one temporal dimension, just as we're used to it? That's one of the questions that is a very big challenge for many quantum gravity theories. If you have some wild assumption about what is going on the small scales, can you reproduce the behavior that you know has to be correct on the large scales? So this is one of these consistency checks with which quantum gravity theories are faced by.
Okay, very interesting.
If I may add to that, I think why many people like Astrid are interested in this sort of consistency checks, because they have been useful historically. Mm-hmm. Dirac found the positron by demanding consistency of quantum mechanics and special relativity. And he came up with a beautiful equation that predicted that. And similarly, Einstein, by demanding some consistency of special relativity with thinking about special relativity very carefully and the Newton's theory and other ideas, he came up with general relativity. Okay. And those sort of structures that we came up with in physics, because they describe the universe so well, and because some of them predated the experiments that verified them, I think many more maybe theoretically inclined humans are very much enamored by that sort of way of proceeding, and it has been successful.
Okay.
So,
quantum gravity people would really love to be guided by experiments, but we can't, right? I mean, so it's not like, you know, people choose to just look at theory and turn away from experiment. We would love to have one. So if you come up with an idea,
tomorrow morning.
yeah, no, it's maybe possible. I mean, Yeah, but it is part of the challenge in quantum gravity. And when you're trying to unify in the gravity and with the quantum, it's actually part of the challenge to say, how am I going to test this? And maybe there is ways. So that's one and part of a lot of the discussion is to try to find ways where we can probe such a high energy because it's such...
Yeah.
We believe there's so much stuff there at the at this high scale.
Okay, great. So one of the things you've talked about, particularly Uite, was some of the thinking that physicists have. And when I think of that as thinking to solve problems, because we have a lot of problems and mysteries in science. I was guessing, wanting a question for all of the panel. Do you see much of a connection? I mean, there are all sorts of other problems we face. I mean, I have the problem of how to fix my car, how to fit everything in my suitcase before a trip, how to fix the toaster. Do you see much of a link between the science problem solving and problems you have to face in everyday life? So I guess what I'm really asking is, does being a theoretical physicist make you better at fixing your toaster?
No.
No.
Definitely not. Unfortunately not, yeah.
You mean breaking our toaster?
Yeah.
That we're good at. But I mean, I think if maybe the another question that can be asked in this regard is, does it help you in daily problems? Like you mentioned, your car and going on trips. Well, one thing you don't have to worry so much about right now is how to get to where you wanted to go.
Uh-huh.
And GPS is the way to go nowadays, or Google Maps. But GPS would not have been able to function if it wasn't for our understanding of special relativity and general relativity. So pretty much everything else about the GPS system we could have gotten with 19th century physics, you know, how to launch the missile. We sort of understood that. We didn't have the technology for that, but we sort of understood that. ENM was there. But those small corrections that come about because the satellite is moving fast with respect to the Earth, and those small corrections that come about because the satellite is, in fact, at a slightly lower potential than you are, or actually, if you think about the minus sign, a slightly higher potential. Those effects come into the how fast the clock tick. And over the course of a day, you're missing about a microsecond. And that will translate to 10 kilometers a day about. And so if it wasn't for special relativity, you would be driving to Montreal, but get to Denver or something like that. Which may be not a bad idea in the winter, but to ski a little bit. But definitely that was a direct translation of modern science into a very practical problem of how to get to places.
But going back to your question, you know, how thinking in everyday problems relates to thinking in science or in physics, I would say it's not really that much different. You know, if you have a broken car, then you just get out your toolbox and you see which of your tools applies and if you can fix your car and if you can't. Of course, the difference to physics is that in physics, sometimes you just have to invent a totally new tool and invent new mathematics in order to solve the problem. That's what you usually don't have to do when you have to fix your car. But the way of thinking is very similar in many, many aspects. And maybe one thing which is also different often is that usually you can fix your car by your own. But in physics, it's very rarely that you have this lonely genius who's been shut up for 100 years not talking to anybody else and coming up with the great theory of everything. Usually physics really progresses in a community, and even if it's a few people who stand out and get Nobel Prizes, it's really discussions to other people which has also helped those people to develop their ideas. So I think that's also one of the points which is maybe important to emphasize, that physics really works as a community of people working together on one project.
Maybe actually I can even push this car analogy further, because I mean it's true that in some sense like fixing your car is part of the job of being a scientist is very similar. It's that you have to first you have to realize you have a problem, so that usually requires you knowing about cars and knowing maybe even your car in particular. And so you have to realize there's a problem. And so that's usually, in fact, in science, imagine that you have a lot of people all driving the same cars. It's one theory. And some theories are just like so broken. It's obvious to everybody that's in that car that it's broken, but they're trying to fix it, you know, in some ways. And some theories are just unfixable, and they're broken cars, you know, going to nowhere. But But other theories, people are just trying to fix them. And fixing sometimes is very clear. You have an hypothesis, and you have your tools, and you just go ahead and you just try to test and try to fix what's wrong with the particular theory that you're interested. But there's another aspect to science, which where sometimes it just says, I'm just spending so much money fixing this car all the time. What if I was to reinvent the notion of car? What if I was to just, you know, change the city so that we don't need cars? What if I just, so this is where you sit back and one day you're just seemingly getting nothing done because you're just sitting and looking in the air or just talking with people and just trying to, this is where the really creative part, you know, there's the technical part, which good scientists are just have a good balance between the two. One day you'll just be going through the tools, you know, math, essentially, and you're just testing your theory, you're just going through, you're just working out, trying to fix things if they're broken or just invent them. But sometimes you're just sitting back and just saying, now let's just try something completely new. Let's just, you know, and this is not something that's just to science. I mean, in any innovative companies, you know, this is what happens. You spend days just trying to do the things that should be done, that needs to be done, and you're just either catching up to some other companies or you just need to work it out. And you spend other days trying to say, what is it that will revolutionize whatever, if your company's whatever market here, and where will revolutionize the fields. And so that you don't usually do with your car, but that's what a scientist also would do. So in that sense, it's different.
Okay, great. So from kind of the habits of mind, we've looked sort of at the current theories, proposed theories, and if I get my crystal ball out, look into the future, will this process ever end of problem solving? Will we ever learn everything about the universe in physics?
I think we'll probably run out of money before we do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
But more seriously, I think it's really a question of what are the problems you have in mind that you want to solve, because already in terms of energy frontier, it's not clear we'll be able to really go much beyond what we have today, just fiscally and technologically. It's becoming much too expensive and much too complex. And so unless there is a big technological breakthrough of how to push protons faster than we know today, it seems unlikely we will be able to go much beyond the current accelerator. And that means that this microscope that Istrid mentioned is never going to be built. You're never going to be able to probe into distances which are much shorter than what we can do today. But it's important to realize that first of all, even particle physics doesn't only progress through large accelerators. There are other efforts. These dark matter efforts that are being built today are such new horizons. But also there are very deep other questions. And I think, by the way, I think maybe Louis can tell us some more about it, but cosmology is not too far away from that situation as well, where we are clearly running into some...
Yes, well, maybe I can get it up now, but indeed, it's not the thing in my hands is not necessarily our ideas, but unfortunately, the real obstacle is at some point it may just be hard to test some theories, because in particle physics, there's nothing in principle because we could if we could build a machine that goes to higher energy, the next LHC, then it would just, you know, it would be fine, but there is just financially and you know. Just the size-wise, you know, the size of the planet kind of thing, puts some limitation. But in cosmology, the limitation is actually the number of bits, just an amount of information out there. Because again, cosmology is a weird science because it's not experimental. The only reason why we can make sense of it is because we just look at the sky and we see many, many different things that repeat itself. And so, if you look at the whole sky, you see so many different things. It's as if you had created all these galaxies with different slightly composition and stuff, and then you learn things. But there's a definite finite number of bit size of stuff you can get out of there. And so there's some experiments, and in particular the theories I'm interested in the early universe, there's like an experiment in Europe right now, the Planck experiment. And I'm waiting very expectantly for this experiment, but if it doesn't see a couple of things, then I'm very sad because I will be set with like four pieces of data to test my theories, which is just not enough. And so at some point, you just need the data to test the theories, and there's a limited number, essentially, in the sky, anyway, in cosmology. there's a limited number because we cannot reproduce it. So we're just, it's a sample, and we know how big it is. I mean, there's still a long future before we really exploit all that data. But there's, in principle, there's a finite number of bit of information. There's just one sky we can see. There's just one universe.
Yeah.
There's an observable universe, and that's one limitation right there.
Right.
So there's a limit to how much we can say when you just have one thing. You know? Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Astrid, you work in quantum gravity, and one of the things you talked about was the idea of it's really unifying quantum physics and theories of gravity. And this idea of unifying things has been a grand kind of narrative throughout the history of science. Newton, centuries ago, coming up with the unified theory of gravity, Maxwell unifying electricity and magnetism. How do you see quantum gravity fitting into this whole kind of push to kind of unify and neaten everything up?
Well, so unifying different theories is really what theorists have been doing for a long time, as you said. And the basic idea why we like this so much is, you know, if you want to explain nature, then we don't want to have one basic assumption that we have to put in for every experiment that we make. What we would really like to have is that we have one basic theory from which we can predict everything, right? And so that we just have a very, very small number of assumptions that we have to make about physics, and from that we can really understand everything that goes on in our universe, from the largest galaxies to everything that goes on in this room, to even to biological systems. Mm-hmm. And so this is why unifying different theories is so very, very interesting, and why people try to do that. Now, of course, you have to be a bit careful when you say, well, it's great to unify theories, let's try to do this. For example, many people in quantum gravity like to think that maybe a quantum gravity theory is only possible if we also include elementary particles into it and build a unified theory of quantum gravity and matter at the same time. Now, of course, it would be nice, but you have to be careful. You know, when you like this idea of unification so much, you shouldn't be led into thinking that this is the only way it can go. Maybe the two theories that we have at some point in time just cannot be unified. So I think it's a very important principle in physics unification, but on the other hand, you have to be careful with principles like that, not to be led into a direction where just nature doesn't want to go. Maybe nature doesn't want to unify elementary particles and gravity. So then we shouldn't try to do this.
Yeah.
So it has two sides to it, this unification thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point we developed a certain bias because the idea of unification has been so successful over the last probably 400 years. And in some sense, it's going back to this idea of Occam razor that you would want to explain as many things as you can with as few assumptions as possible, but no less. And this idea of unification is, in a sense, the mathematical description of that. And to be able to suddenly talk about so many phenomena in terms of a very simple number of equations is really at the heart of what science is trying to achieve. But and indeed, it was successful with Maxwell when he realized that magnetic fields and electric fields are the two manifestations of the same basic quantity. Yeah. And later on, in the 20th century, of course, had the idea that, in fact, the radioactivity, as I mentioned, is part of this electromagnetic field, and that led to additional unification. Mm-hmm. And maybe our first glance at a failure was when people in the 80s constructed those grand unified theories that looked beautiful on paper, and they took all the known forces except for gravity and put them in a single force at very high energies, and they even had a prediction that the proton decays. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it didn't. And that was the first maybe failure of that that paradigm. Of course, it doesn't rule out a paradigm because it maybe is that it's a slight variation on that, and that goes back to what we mentioned before, that a single experiment doesn't kill a paradigm. It has to be an evolution of several things. But I think it ties nicely to what Astrid mentions, that we really shouldn't bias ourselves too much with paradigms, and keep in mind that maybe different.
Okay, great. So we've got one more question before we go on to question and answer with the audience. And I guess as we've kind of just looking ahead a couple of years, what are some of the things, you know, if I'm interested in science, I've kind of been following things, I know what's happening, maybe the next, you know, 3 years or something that I should look out for, big events that might happen or critical experiments or big ideas that might be tested?
Louis?
Well, dark matter, definitely one of the big things. This is my prediction for one of the ones that we should really be able to settle. I mean, there's an okay, so one of the hypotheses for dark matter is that it's a particle that's weakly interacting. And if that's true, there should be, I mean, all the evidence, there should be a way to test this on the planet. So all the evidence we have right now for dark matter is through gravity, essentially through its indirect gravitational pull in the cosmos. That's the evidence we have for this object called dark matter. It's the fact, it's all it's acting in the universe. But you should not believe anything if that anything about dark matter if that's the only thing we have, okay? Because it's not, I mean, it's there's a lot of, you know, it fits nicely, but still, it's not, nobody really believes in dark matter just because of that. We are all looking forward for direct detection of dark matter, where what we want is if it's true that dark matter is a small particle, it should sometime, very weakly maybe, but interact with us. And we have tons of experiments going on all across the world right now looking for this. In particular, here in Sudbury at Snow Lab, there's tons of, well, Snow Lab is one of the experiments, but at Sudbury in the mine, 2 kilometers down, they have tons of stuff looking for this dark matter. And so there's so many of them, although it looks like a mess. There was a dark matter conference recently, and I was like, what's going on in this field? But it looks like right now it's a bit messy, but hopefully this is something that should make the headlines in the 10 to 15 years, maybe, I don't know. Dark energy will be great, but that one might take a little longer before, a lot longer before we figure out what it is. Yeah. We can go on about this, but dark energy is a lot more mysterious, and it just doesn't seem to be any, there's no real experiment going on right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're trying to see whether dark energy could vary in time. Yep. That's the best experiment we have right now. So dark energy, again, is the smooth energy all across the universe and makes it go faster. And it's just not clear how we're gonna test that. So that one is not so much in the near future.
Okay, fantastic. Astrid?
So, well, one very interesting thing that we are hopefully finally going to see is a very important prediction of general relativity, namely gravitational waves. So gravitational waves are very similar to water waves, but what they curve is indeed space-time. So when a gravitational wave passes through this room, it means that the distance between me and the table will be shorter, and then it will be longer again, and then we'll just settle back to what it is now. And so we can see gravitational waves at these huge interferometer experiments, where we just have a laser bouncing between mirrors, and then we can see if the distance between these two mirrors becomes shorter and then longer again. And so gravitational waves are really important because they are very central prediction of general relativity, and this is just the theory of gravity that we believe is valid up to all these smallest scales where quantum gravity becomes important. But if we don't see gravitational waves, then this means that something is very, very deeply wrong with general relativity, and this also affects our understanding of everything in astrophysics and cosmology. And then so there are a number of experiments which, as far as I know, I'm not an expert in these experiments, should have the sensitivity to see gravitational waves coming from the universe. So these come from very, very interesting regions. Mm-hmm. They come from regions in the universe where, for example, two black holes spiral around each other and merge. So this is a very violent event. It really shakes up space-time. It gets all wobbly, and these gravitational waves then arrive here, and we will hopefully see them in the near future.
Okay, fantastic. So Itai, I believe we have about 1 minute.
Well, the LHC, that's it.
Okay. So end of story.
So I think we really hope to see some new particles at the LHC, and that'll be great.
Okay, fantastic. So we might move on to question and answer period. So we have, some microphone up near the back of the room, and I believe the procedure is if you go to the back, there may be someone there, and to guide you to the back, I believe so, and ask your question from there. Oh.
Not everyone at once.
Okay.
Thank you. This has been very, very educational. Really enjoyed it so far. I have a question, and I think, gentleman on the left, I forget your name.
Sorry.
You kind of touched on it a little bit. My question is about the trust of set paradigms that are out there already. I listen to the news right now. They've done tests and they've implemented testing for the public on prostate cancer that they're now questioning. Sodium intake, they're questioning, but these were previously all set in stone that this is the way it has to be. A lot of what you have to research and base your theories on probably stem from theories that are already out there from the past, whether it's a century ago, whether it's from the 80s, as you mentioned. How do you trust that? Like, I guess, do you have to, like maybe with computerization and
models?
Well,
so I think the basic answer is no, not computers. We don't trust them. 2001.
Okay. yes.
We do experiments. And I think the big difference between physics, for example, and health science and other such sciences is that our experiments are a luxury. They are much more controlled. We know everything that we put into them, and we know everything that is going on in them. We don't have control groups. We know exactly what's in it. And we do it many, many times over. So the data we have now, the theories that we are working on with right now, have been tested thousands of times. Okay. And not to a precision that anyone in the health science will ever imagine. We are talking about precision of several digits, and in some crazy cases, up to 12 significant digits. So the short answer is that we simply experiment, and our experiments are very, very well controlled and designed.
Right. And you have to prove the theories that are already set?
No, so as I said before, we don't prove things in science.
Okay, right.
We only gain confidence in theories. And if I see a theory that predicts to me 100 observables, and I go and test each one of those 100 observables, and they each check to 3 significant digits, call me crazy, but I'll say the theory is pretty well established.
Okay, thank you very much.
We do have some online viewers, and we have a question from Alberta Girl. Itai, she says, you mentioned GPS devices making use of Einstein's theory of special relativity. What other devices that students may be familiar with make use of this theory?
That's a good question. You're putting me on the spot. I actually had an answer for this.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe we should move on to another question.
Yeah,
I will come up with the answer.
I'm not sure.
We'll come back.
Yeah.
Unless someone else knows, but I'll come up with the answer.
Yeah.
Okay. I have two comments. First, I think you should stress the recognition of connection, like Newton and the apple falling down, and he looks up and sees the moon going around, and he unifies the two forces. Darwin, seeing the various birds and recognizing, and even the guy who discovered tectonic plates. So that's one thing. I'd like to see if you have a personal experience of something that you have seen connections that may not have been seen before. And my second question, I would like to ask each of you separately, what was it in your childhood that brought you to where you are today?
Yeah, I think no, it's a very good point about the connections. I mean, a good part of what we do is to try to find patterns, and sometimes it's really particularly the example that we're just given. This is a stroke of genius to see the patterns in some places where nobody had seen them before. Not sure exactly if I had an example in mind for. Yeah, I have to come up something that happened recently. I mean, it is the emergence of the standard model. The one I'm more familiar with is this emergence of this big picture with the Big Bang and the standard model of cosmology, where now we have this dark matter, this dark energy. I sort of witnessed that coming up, and the dark energy in '98 was the one of the last puzzle, and suddenly just all fitted together. In some sense, I was an emergence in its own, just because it just was. Before that, in my field, it was just no standard theory. There was just a bunch of ideas, and it was just not really fitting. And now we have a one theory at the very least, and the theory is mostly based. We call it lambda CDM, and that's because it's essentially lambda is referred to the dark energy, and the CDM means cold dark matter. And so it's not a very popular name, you won't hear it so much, but really, it's a very powerful paradigm. And so it's very amazing how it just somewhat emerged like this. Yeah. And I guess the second part of the question is what brought me here. Well, that's a good question. I actually kind of was late in being interested in physics. I was deciding between undergrad, I was going around, I was maybe thinking of philosophy, physics, I was unsure really. And somebody told me that philosophy was not very useful compared to physics. Now that was their opinion, I'm not saying that.
Crazy thoughts.
Yeah, I didn't say, okay, well, I said, well, then let's try physics. And then it got really a lot of fun somehow. And I was very lucky, and also I was very lucky in my getting admitted to Cornell. It was pure luck because I was just, somebody said, oh, you should apply, and the only university I applied to almost. Wow. And it's not like I did Harvard and everything. I just applied to Cornell. I had just no clue. I was just clueless. And it was just a great tournament event because it was a great place, and I enjoyed it. So that's my story.
So Astrid, what was it with you and getting into physics?
Well, it was a bit similar. I also wasn't interested in physics for a very long time, or not sure that I would be interested in it. And then I was interested in a lot of other things and was thinking about studying something related to biology maybe for a long time. And then I just had a very great high school teacher, so I really cannot overemphasize the importance of this teacher. I certainly wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for this teacher. And so what I just discovered in his lectures was that it's so much fun to do physics, you know, thinking about these basic problems, the very basic questions like where does the universe come from, why is it that we have four dimensions, all these very basic questions that you start asking when you're a little child. And that you can actually try to answer with physics. So that's so exciting, and this just got me there and I started to study physics.
Okay, fantastic. We might move on to the next question.
Maybe before we do, I can tell regarding the last question about special relativity.
Yes, absolutely.
Just to make sure we are being honest. So there are two beautiful applications. There are many more, but here are two. Nuclear power is an application of special relativity because the idea of converting the mass into energy is one of the fundamentals of special relativity. Another one that is not as often appreciated is today when you go to do your medical checkup and if there is a real need, they'll send you to a PET scan. A PET scan is done through the existence of a positron that gets injected into your body, never mind how, but it meets another electron. There are trades of secrets of the trade. meets another electron and together they annihilate to produce light that gets detected outside. Now, even the mere existence of the positron is a prediction of special relativity together with quantum mechanics. The fact that the positron can annihilate with the electron and produce pure light, pure energy, is another such prediction. And your medical bills are associated with that prediction. So,
fantastic. The next question.
Faster than light neutrinos. You are obviously fairly desperate to recreate the experiment, reproduce the results of the experiment. How do you go about doing that? It doesn't sound particularly practical to build a new LHC with various tunnels pointing in the direction of some other convenient neutrino detector. How practical is it, or would you actually do to reproduce that?
So it turns out that there is another experiment already in place in our continent. And Fermilab is the next largest accelerator in the world, and it's been operating long before the LHC. And they have such a beam ready, and we also have an underground lab ready far away from that. I think it's in Dakota, I believe. And they, in fact, already have a measurement of that. Now, the Korn measurement is not statistically significant, so we can't really rely on that. But they have all the setup ready to produce a measurement of the same quantity. Now, that being said, it's a little tricky because one of the major problems of that experiment are the systematics, is that there are certain quantities that are just very difficult to measure. And if you want to retest this or re-examine this idea, you really don't want to just repeat the same experiments elsewhere. You really want to be able to design or to try to design a slightly different experiment with that is sensitive to different systematics and different effects so that when you get the positive confirmation, you know that you really have tested it in two different, very different ways. So that is still in the making, and I don't know what is... That will take a while. That's not going to happen over time. overnight.
So did Fermilab just happen to have tunnels pointing in the right direction, or was it built deliberately?
No, it was. Well, the you don't need to build a tunnel. You need to aim your protons at a target. I think it's copper that they aim it at. The protons collide with the target. At that point, they produce pions and other wonderful particles. At the end of this cascade, neutrinos emerge. Other things, other stuff also emerges, but they get stopped. Neutrinos are so weakly interacting. In fact, neutrinos would have been perfect dark matter, only that they're not. They don't need a tunnel. They just pierce through the Earth as if it wasn't there. And if you direct your beam correctly, you know where it's going, and you can point it towards the underground lab.
Fantastic. We'll move on to the next question.
Thank you very much for a very interesting presentation. You alluded to the idea that as innovations and new ideas came along, there was often initial resistance to them, and then they gradually became mainstream, and then maybe they even adapted later on. And it seems that maybe the speed at which we adopt new ideas allows us to progress faster, but if we adopt them too fast, we may be in danger of going in the wrong direction. I just wonder, especially with this organization, Perimeter Institute, other things that are happening now, maybe with the World Wide Web, with Perimeter Institute, that allow us to kind of come to consensus of how fast we can move forward, and are we kind of accelerating the rate of our ability to share those ideas, or are we moving too fast and in danger of kind of going off at a tangent?
Well, I would say physicists are usually rather conservative people, so they don't jump at new ideas and say, well, that's great, let's embrace it. They really like what they have, and so they are very, very slow in adapting new ideas. And so I think with the physics community, the danger that new ideas just kind of hypes get adapted too quickly and new paradigms which are not correct are adapted is not as big as maybe in other areas, even though the amount of information maybe just growing since, you know, we have the World Wide Web, we can access all kinds of other experiments, publications and stuff much, much quicker. So we can access ideas much quicker, but that doesn't mean that we adapt them much quicker.
But yeah, I think Astrid is totally right. In fact, it's counterintuitive, but I found that scientists often are much slower than the general public to accept anything, including even technology sometimes. And most scientists, I would say, don't know how to use their smartphone or anything. So they're very slow and they're very critical. So in fact, we're, if anything, putting a brake on many things. But it's true that the one thing that has changed is the dissemination of information. It's just massive now. It's just you see all the everybody is publishing their work very quickly. It's right away on the internet, and it just goes, it's just nonstop every day. We just get this deluge of information. So and so that's good and bad. There's a lot of good because suddenly there's just much more sharing, but it's bad also because there's just, and this is a general problem with maybe with the internet, it's just so much information that it's very hard to get the gist of it, essentially. So that's one of the things.
Fantastic. So I've got a question of my own. I see we don't have any live ones just at the moment. But one of the questions was about talking about relativity, what practical impact and inventions and it has on everyday life. What if we broaden that question? What about other theories like quantum physics? I mean, how much have they impacted, you know, if I'm just an average person, so to speak?
Well, really quite a lot because, you know, quantum physics, it allows atoms to be stable. If you just have the classical theory, then atoms decay really, really quickly. So you know, just to allow you to sit here, we really need quantum mechanics. And then also, in order to understand what goes on inside solid matter, like crystals and stuff, we really need quantum mechanics. And so the technology that is built on it is basically most of the technology that we use, ranging from mobile phones to all your laptops, so there's quantum mechanics in all of that. And certainly the founding fathers of quantum mechanics did not envision this. And so I think this is a very important message that when you do foundational research, you typically don't see what kind of application may come out of it. But that doesn't mean that there won't be an application in 50 years or in 100 years. And so if you want a sustainable development of technologies, you need just foundational research where you don't see any application right now, because, you know, the next generation will certainly make use of it and will invent technology based on it. And so, you know, it's not good to be short-sighted in research and just do stuff where you immediately see what application will come out of it.
And also, I think there is a lot of feedback or sort of byproducts. For example, you know, in those very large accelerators that we're building, it's unlikely that any of those exotic particles we're finding will have applications anytime soon. But the technology that allows us to produce them is something that took us a while to build, and we're now using it elsewhere. We have micro drillers using this technology. We have the PET scan that I mentioned, that you get that through accelerators. You produce radioactive isotopes that ultimately, that's how they inject this into you, by the way. So there is really also this whole byproduct business of by really trying to go to the frontier, you have to invent those incredible tools, and those tools ultimately end up having applications elsewhere. So it's really a multifaceted journey that gives you application in many places. And you know, you mentioned the applications. One application is your microwave, right? You go home and you heat up your food. And one experiment I suggest all of you to do is to you can put marshmallows on your plate of don't make the plate rotate, just take that stuff out, but put marshmallows everywhere, and if you turn on your microwave, after a while you'll see that only certain marshmallows got fried and others didn't. It's because there is actually a standing wave inside the cavities that bakes some of them but doesn't bake others. And this idea is the basic idea of electromagnetism. But the reason why it's connected to quantum mechanics is because it's aimed at a very particular transition. That wavelength that you see in your marshmallows is aimed at a very particular transition in water, that if it wasn't for quantum mechanics, there wouldn't be that particular transition.
Wow, fascinating. Physics.
Are you going to try that?
We've actually done that at Perimeter before.
All right.
And I'm sure what you were going to say, if there were any young children watching online were thinking about doing this, they would talk to their mum and dad first before doing that. So thank you for mentioning that. We've got one more question at the back.
I actually have two questions. The first one is regarding dark energy. Do you believe that it could possibly be represented as a larger spectrum of particles in exotic energy as opposed to just dark energy?
Well, I think we don't really know. We don't know what dark energy is right now. It definitely does not behave like a gas of particle of any type we've seen. So it doesn't behave like. So essentially, particles are either cold a little bit, like dark matter is a cold gas of particle, or it's relativistic. So we say hot, essentially like radiation, like light, and both of these will behave completely differently. So. What happens, and the main properties that's important is any of these particles, standard particles that we know, they tend to dilute. So the universe is expanding, so everything is going away from each other. And if you have a gas of normal, that we know particles, or light, it dilutes as the universe expands. And what's different about dark energy is it just does not dilute. It stays there, it stays smooth, and as the universe expands, it's just more of it in some sense. The density does not decrease. And that's very strange. And so we don't know really what it is. One thing that seems like it could behave like this is simply the energy of the vacuum. That's probably the best we can say. I would say is just that the vacuum itself has some quantum fluctuation, and that if that has energy, that would essentially stays constant and the universe expands. And so I don't think particles as we know them would do it.
Okay,
the second
great answer.
Question.
So just maybe if we, I just see we have one more questioner, just to be kind of consistent, if we can just keep limit it to one question. Thank you.
The Perimeter Institute has brought together so many different physics disciplines. I wonder how much it's sped up your general knowledge of physics generally. And what about the 150 other research institutes in this area, including some other quite famous ones? How much is this mashup all coming together, bringing all our knowledge forward?
So I'm in fact an associate member with McMaster University. So there are now several such associate members that are present as professors in university and also researchers in PI. And I can tell you from personal experience that it's been great that is helping both ends to allow us to have students, to have PI ideas. For example, just before this event, I was speaking to our outreach director, Greg Dix, that they PI made those wonderful videos and whole packages about physics for undergraduates in high school, and I'm planning to bring it to the class I'm teaching in first-year undergraduates. So the connection is very, very real and very practical.
Great.
We have another question from online. A scientist, they don't say where they're from though. Let's suppose that tomorrow, one of the scientists that you work with here suggests to you that to address the questions you are interested in, you should learn a fundamentally new scientific or formal language not related to your education. It means you need to start completely anew. How difficult would it be for you at this stage of your career to start completely new?
Astrid, did you want to start that?
Well, I think this is one of the great things maybe of Perimeter Institute, that really encourages one to take new routes, to be creative, and to follow paths which have not been gone before. So in many other places, you get there, you arrive as a new postdoc, mm-hmm. and there's somebody who tells you that you get involved with the project that they have. And here you just get there and people encourage you to start new things, to work on your own. So, of course, it's always hard to learn a new tool. But as a physicist, you're usually trained to be able to do that. And this is, I think, one of the greatest places to be able to do that.
Yeah, no, indeed. It's very true that at some point in your training as a physicist, the thing you're trained for is actually learning new things fast. I mean, it's really mm-hmm. not so much at some point knowledge, just because it's not about remembering in particular. You need to just I need to remember. You don't remember how this particular equation goes like, or how do you find, you know, you have the general ideas, and then you can just rederive or rediscover or relearn something on the spot, essentially. And that's when you're getting somewhat, you know, better at your trade. But we do this relatively all the time, trying to learn new things. It's sure that if you start completely new, it might take a while, but still, it's you know, it's part of the job. You just sit down and work out through books. I mean, most of the time, it's just you start with a textbook, so you're not. But then obviously, when you get to the research, that's where the textbooks mm-hmm. are no longer useful. But we often do that. I think we start from scratch and learn something slightly new every day.
Okay, great. I think one.
Yeah, we have one more question from online. Steve Fistel asks, is there anything in the in-between of space from one state to another? In other words, is there a discrete jump in a transition phase from state to state? Or is there a fuzzy continuous transition without identifying the so-called in-between?
So, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in space. In fact, there is a whole interstellar and intergalactic medium. And in fact, there is so many ions there. Ions are charged particles. That they provide a medium for photons to propagate. And so you learn that photons propagate at a certain speed, but in fact, when they go in space, they are slightly attenuated by that vast medium that is in between. So not only do we have stars and gas and so many other things, the universe is filled with these ions that also slightly attenuate the light. So I think
it's still surprisingly empty, though. I should.
It is surprisingly empty. Yes.
The universe there are the biggest object in the universe are galaxy clusters, but it's also just void. Really, just big holes where there's just nothing. It's a surprisingly big universe, and
Okay. Yeah. And Astrid, you're from the quantum gravity perspective. We're looking at fundamentally what's space and in between.
Yeah, well, that's a really difficult question. If you think of space as being built out of this little atoms of space, and then what does it mean in between? I mean, what it says is that, you know, that you don't have any space in between. You just jump from one point to the other. There is no in between. So this is one of these points where actually our understanding or our intuition actually is very difficult to assess these ideas. So that's where we have to go back a bit to phrase it in terms of mathematical language, and it's very difficult to adapt it to our everyday intuition and understanding. So this is where we are really challenged to come up with new ways of thinking about old concepts.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a great point. There's kind of new ways of thinking. Perhaps to end on the night. So I'll be going for about an hour and a half now. So I've learned a lot. I learned that perhaps my dark matter entrepreneurial business is not going to succeed, so I have to go back to the drawing boards. But I think I learned about, really, from people at the coalface of science, how it works, how science is actually being done today, how there are many, many new mysteries out there, and how experiment theory may work in hand-to-hand with intuition and kind of assumptions to help us kind of further along in terms of solving those. So Itay Yavin, Astrid Eichthorn, and Louis LeBlanc, thank you very much. And thank you to audience online and here in the Black Hole Bistro.